This morning, we're going to continue in our series, The Face of Grace. And for those of you who are here for the first time, and I met a few of you who came this morning, you got to understand something about Emmanuel. We're a little bit different. We do not tell people they have to come to church. No, because you are the church. And wherever you go, God is. So the fact that you came this morning means that you're ready to not only worship the Lord, but to be encouraged. And that's my job, to encourage you. And then you also come to be an encouragement to others. That's your job. And I've already given you one way you can encourage the Arakan family. But the people sitting around you, you can encourage them as well. And I want to show you how this morning as we continue our study on grace. What does grace look like? If you're here this morning and you have faith in Jesus Christ, the God of all grace has indwelt your heart. The only description we have of Jesus in the New Testament is he was a man full of grace and truth. When you come to know him, you are called a little Christ. That's what the word Christian means. So that you're to be a person full of grace. By the way, the picture that you have of Jesus in your mind, long hair, beard, Caucasian skin, that's not the way Jesus would have looked. No, he would have had short hair. He would have been clean shaven. He would have had dark skin. He would have looked more Middle Eastern than the image that you have of him maybe hanging on your wall or that you see in hospitals and so on. You say, well, now, wait a minute. Where did we get that long flowing hair image of Jesus, long, well-cropped beard of Jesus with the Caucasian beautiful smile? Where does that come from? Well, that's a whole nother lesson, but it's fascinating. I'll go ahead and jump to the end and tell you that that's an image that the ancient Greeks and the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Romans used to picture their gods, Zeus, Apollo, Isis, and so on. You say, what? Yeah, That's why I would say to you, worship the Lord in spirit and in truth. And realize if you want to know who Jesus is, don't go to a physical image. Go to grace. Now, what's fascinating about grace is this. We can say we believe in grace. We can teach it. We can preach it. We can sing it. You can even call yourself a person of grace. But are you living graciously? You know, the ancients, when they had plays at theaters, they would go to what we would call Broadway. They would go and they would watch actors. Do you know how they acted back in the day? They would take a mask, and if they wanted to express happiness, they'd put the mask in front of their face, and then they'd speak from behind the mask. Or if they wanted to show sadness, they'd put a mask in front of them and speak from behind a mask of a face that showed sadness. We get our word hypocrite from the Greek. Hupo, behind, Christo, the mask. A hypocrite is one who presents a face, who says, I'm a Christian. But in reality, behind the mask, there is no grace. So this morning, I'm going to show you what grace is. Grace is undeserved favor. It is favor bestowed upon someone who doesn't deserve it. And this morning, I want you to see that a person full of grace will move toward, be sensitive to the hurts of other people. Now, let me start off by saying that there is a difference, a big difference, between your hurts and others' hurts. We're not talking about your hurts this morning. We're not talking about you being hurt because someone didn't press like on Facebook. Somebody didn't send you a wedding invitation. Somebody overlooked you or didn't speak to you in the hallway of the church. Or maybe when they spoke to you in a way that you felt like you didn't deserve. We're not talking about your hurts. I want to ask you a question. Do you often express to other people how hurt you are by the slights of others? Do you? If you do, that is the opposite end of grace. A person without grace will constantly talk about how hurt they are from the slights of others, but a person full of grace is sensitive to and moves toward others who hurt. So, let's talk about that. How do we know if somebody is hurting? You know, my wife is fond of saying this, and it's true. Hurting people will hurt others. You may have heard it as hurt people hurt people. The first hurt is an adjective, hurt people. The second hurt is a verb, hurt people. How do we know if people around us are hurting? What are some of the telltale indications? Well, first of all, they're quick with attacking words. I mean, words that cut. They fly off the handle, very angry. There's some hurt in that person. They assume you're against them. It's just an assumption. Everybody's against me. The world's against me. Now, why do they assume that? Well, they can't trust the God of all grace who has the world under his control. They've got to trust their own control. And if things feel out of control, well, then they assume that you're the enemy because they can't control you. Hurt people are unable to see the pain that they inflict. It's always about the pain that they bear, but they're blind to the pain they give. Hurt people can't figure out why others don't understand what they're going through. Nobody seems to understand. Nobody cares. That's a sign of someone who's hurt. They're defensive, and they never let their guards down. That's why the finger of the hurting person is always pointing to someone else, because a finger point, you're the problem, you're the problem, is like a fence with a barb at the end. It keeps people away. Hurt people, they don't take responsibility because it's everybody else's problem. Then they're the ones who have to fix it. It's not me. Hurting people want to help others without ever looking within to see where the hurt may be within themselves. Hurt people are quick to react in anger. They're easily offended. And because they're easily offended, they'll just come at you with their anger. Hurt people would rather fight than listen. And hurt people rarely, rarely have close friendships. Now, do you know anybody like that? Is there anybody in your life that's hurting? What do? Grace moves toward people who are hurting. Now, in the world, when hurting people come around us, the world moves away from them. But grace people move toward. Now, it's human to feel grieved when hurting people hurt you. And it's human to want to pull away. But it is divine to move toward that person who has grieved you. Are you with me? Guys, listen to me. If you ever want to know what grace looks like in your marriage, it is when your wife, who is hurting, says things, does things, is quick to anger, says cutting things, and you move toward her. You say, whoa, that's impossible. No, that's grace. You know, the opposite of grace is to avoid people. The opposite of grace is to say, I'm done. I'm washing my hands. I'm not going to put up with that anymore. You say, well, Pastor, I've got to have boundaries. No, you're misunderstanding. Of course you can have boundaries. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the person who is hurting, who hurts because they're hurting. You move toward them. That's grace. By the way, it's one of the great requirements for being a pastor. You have to be a person who moves toward people who are offended at you. Because if you ever withdraw from people offended with you, you're disqualified from being a pastor, a gospel pastor. Because we speak good news. And the good news is that the God of all grace moves toward hurting people. Now let me show you this. This is our text, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1. And before I read it, let me set the background. Anytime the Apostle Paul writes a letter, an epistle is what it's called, he'll always begin with doctrine. The first half of the letter will be about what you're to believe. And then he'll make a transition about halfway through his epistle to behavior or your duty. Paul never begins by telling you what you're to do. He always starts by showing you what you're to believe. Now, why is it important for us to get the order right? Why must we believe correctly before we ever even begin to fulfill a duty? Why? Because if you ever start trying to perform before you got your thinking right about God, you will think what you do brings God pleasure. You will think by your performance and your achievement, then the favor of God will fall on you because you've earned it. And if you ever start living your life as a Christian, trying to perform in order to please, you've missed grace. Because grace is undeserved favor. And it's one of the reasons why people in churches that don't live grace, who are legalistic, fundamentalist, withdraw from people who don't measure up and avoid people that have slighted them. It's why there's really never any healing. My mom may be watching. It's kind of fun. They're celebrating their 60th wedding anniversary Tuesday night. They were married when they were young, but my mom is a professional editor. And she's been listening to this series on grace, and after the first five, I didn't know this, but she was transcribing them. And she's giving them to me. And Lord willing, they could possibly turn into a book, but the spoken word is different than the written word, and there'll have to be a lot of editing, a lot of help from her. But one of the things that she said to me was this. She said, Wade, after about four or five of these messages, I realized that all you were doing was describing the doctrines of grace. I said, yeah, Mom. She said, I never knew that. In fact, my mom grew up in a household where my granddad, who was an evangelist, he called himself a Calvinist. He said he believed in the doctrines of grace. Man, it was a hard house. It was tough. It was performance. It was achievement. It was judgment. It was withdrawing if you didn't perform. There was some abuse that went on. Why? And my mom thought that maybe that's what grace was. And this series has helped her see, no. You can talk about grace all you want, but until you live it, you're a hypocrite. So, Paul begins Ephesians telling us who God is and what His grace is like. It's undeserved. You who were dead in your trespasses and sins, God has made alive, Ephesians 2, verse 7. You who walked in your former ways like this, like the world, like this and this and this, but God. D. Martin Lloyd-Jones says the two greatest words in Scripture are the words, but God. So in the first three chapters of Ephesians, you see how you don't deserve a thing from God, but God. In His favor toward hurting people, move toward you. Now we pick up in Ephesians 4 and verse 1. He goes, as a prisoner for the Lord, then. As a prisoner for the Lord. What does that mean? As a prisoner for the Lord. Well, it simply means God has captured you by His grace. He's taken hold of you. He didn't take hold of you because you deserved it. You were a prisoner in bondage to your sin. And God came, and by His grace, He captured you. Now you're a prisoner of the Lord. And by the way, I'd rather be a prisoner of the Lord than a prisoner in Mexico. I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Now, let me pause right there. When I read that verse and I come across the English word worthy, here's what I think to myself because of my fundamentalist, independent Baptist background. Oh, I got to perform. God's captured me. Now I got to be worthy. God has saved me by His grace. Now I got to achieve. That's the way I grew up. And by the way, I don't blame my dad for that. He was the son of an alcoholic. He got saved when he was a teenager out of a family that didn't know the Lord. And he was trained under independent Baptist fundamentalists who said they believed in grace but didn't practice it. And so it was transferred to our house. Well, I'm telling you something, I'm so proud of my dad. I have seen the transformation in his life. He was a pastor. But I have seen him transform from a man who once taught grace but didn't live it to a man now that lives grace and you catch it. You see, I used to think that the word worthy meant when God captures me by His grace, then I've got to be worthy for Him. No. I've even heard some people say, Pastor, listen, I understand that when I became a Christian, all of my sins were forgiven, all my past sins. But now I've got to achieve the pleasure of God by what I do now. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Where do you get that? I can end that kind of thinking by just one simple question. When Jesus Christ died for you, when the grace of God and His undeserved favor was given to you at the cross, how many of your sins were future then? They were all future. You didn't deserve anything that God did for you, but He did it. Wow. You know what the word worthy in this text means? I'll show you the Greek word. I think there's a better English word to translate it. The Greek word is the word axios, from which we get our word axiom. You know what an axiom is? If you've ever taken math, an axiom is a self-evident truth. It is like something that you see in mathematics that is so self-evident, you don't need to have to compute. You just see it. It's an axiom. Now, let me translate it differently. Let's go back to Ephesians 4 and verse 1. As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life axiomatic with your calling. You say, I still don't understand. Consistent with your calling. That's the better word. Consistent. That's the word axiom. In other words, when people see your life, it's an axiom of the grace of God. The grace of God is so self-evident in the way you live. They don't have to formulate what grace is because they see it in your life. This is how you're to live. Oh, my word. The word urge in this verse, verse 1, means you encourage strongly. It's got the picture of a third base coach in T-ball who is on the sideline, and there's a little kid rounding third going home, and he's saying, go, 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 go. That's what I'm doing today for you. You who've been captured by the grace of God, I urge you, go, go, go. Live your life consistent with your calling. And then he goes on in verse 2 and he says this. Be completely humble. Be gentle. Be patient. Bearing with one another in love. I just have 4 or 5 minutes and I want to close with this little phrase, bearing with one another in love. Before I get there, let me just say to you that because of my personality, I'm an 8 on the Enneagram. My personality is driven. And I have to be careful here because sometimes I see the big picture. I'm a visionary. So I see the big picture and I drive to get to the end of the big picture. And I'm confessing something to you. Sometimes what happens is I move too rashly. I move too boldly. I move too loudly. I'm not as gentle as God's calling of me is. And I seek your forgiveness. I seek my wife's forgiveness all the time. I know that my life is to be consistent with the calling that God has given me. I am to be gentle. I am to be humble. Not in order to get his favor. It's in order that you might look at me and see his grace. But it's that last phrase, bearing with one another in love. Do you remember the Olympics in 1992? Derek Redmond here, the runner. He was the record holder for the 400-meter dash in Great Britain. He came in to the Barcelona Olympics in 1992 as the favorite. He had the fastest time in the preliminary heats. In the semifinals, he's out in the lead. And Derek said he heard a pop, and then he felt pain. And at first, he thought he had been shot. He pulls up, and then he falls to the ground. He had popped a hamstring. He couldn't run anymore. And the world watched as he lay on the track weeping, and then he stood and began to walk. And then out of the stands ran his father, Jim, and put Derek's arm around his shoulder and held him up. And Derek said, Dad, don't. And Jim said to Derek, son, we started this together. We're going to finish this together. And Jim Redmond bore up his son across the finish line of the Barcelona Olympics. That's the word that's used in Ephesians 2:2 or 4:2. It's also used here in Colossians 3, verse 13. Bear with others and forgive whatever grievances you have. Look at this next phrase. As the Lord forgave you. In other words, you can't bear with or bear up someone else if you've moved away moving toward the hurting is grace. Now, there will be times when those who are hurting will draw their boundary and say, don't come any closer, stop. I can't, get away from me, don't come. Then what do you do in that? Well, in respect and love, you stop at that boundary, but you let it be known. I will respect the boundary that you've created, but I want you to know I'm not moving away. I'm staying right here. And when you're ready, I'll always be here. And when you let me in, I'm coming. I could tell you story after story, anecdote after anecdote, from my own pastoral experience. But we're out of time, and needless to say, I say this to our staff all the time. If we're to be a gospel church, and I'm to be a gospel pastor, then it doesn't make any difference what people say of me, do to me, how they treat me. I will move toward them. And I will be there, no matter what. Live in harmony. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate. Be humble. Move toward people who have hurt you. Now you say, Pastor, but there are occasions, let's say, in a marriage where adultery, other things have occurred, and I can't move toward that person because the hurt is too intense and it's too difficult. I understand. Just admit to yourself that the reason you can't move toward is because you're hurting. I talk to people all the time, women and men, who've been abused in their childhood. And when they hear a message like this, in their minds they're thinking, I can't move toward the abuser and forgive them. The hurt is way too intense. Understand. Hold accountable the abuser. They need to be in jail. It's a violation of the law. Absolutely. But move toward that abuser in forgiveness the same way God has moved toward you. And if you can't, that's okay. But just acknowledge that what may be missing is an understanding of how free and full the forgiveness of God is for you. And what may be missing is how unconditional and immeasurable God's favor is for you. So what I've found is usually this in our lives: when we're unable to be gracious, there's usually a maladjustment in our thinking about the graciousness of God toward us. I beg you, as a prisoner of God's grace, go, 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 go. Go toward the hurting in grace and be consistent with the calling that you have received from God.